Thank you very much, Don. It's a pleasure and an honor to address these two societies. I'm a founding member of the Charlottetown Society and have deep sympathies with the Philadelphia Society. And as Don said, I'm an American who's lived in Canada now for 6, going on 7 years. And what I'd like to try to do with you for a few minutes tonight is, well, give a talk that's very much addressed to our American guests, or my fellow Americans, that will try to introduce you to Canada, to Canadian politics in the first place, and then to Canadian conservatism. Because my own experience, and the experience of people I've talked to in the United States, is that Americans tend to think they know pretty much what Canada is, and assume that it's just about the same as the United States. Which is largely true, but not so largely true, but what it's also a big mistake. Americans are largely ignorant of Canada. It's a kind of benign neglect, you could say. They assume it's similar, if not identical, but when we reflect about it, I think most Americans realize we really don't know a hell of a lot about that country up there. It's cold and dark and sort of has natural resources, and they talk like us with a slightly funny accent, and that's sort of how Americans view the country. And I'd like today to try to, tonight to try to begin to point to what I think are important and interesting differences, and begin to start a kind of dialogue that I think will probably be something that will come up over and over again tomorrow in the meetings as well. Better understanding of how the two democracies, which are both democracies, both liberal democracies, both English-speaking liberal democracies, are yet so in interesting and important ways different. One thing I'd like to begin by saying is I don't think we Canadians can really blame Americans for being so ignorant of Canada. Because Canada, what's the root of the ignorance? Canada is a country that really doesn't pose very grave problems. I think Americans are much more likely to think about Nicaragua or Mexico or South America in general than about Canada, and for very good reasons. That Canada is essentially a good ally, a stable, sound democracy with a strong economy, and therefore not an object of our attention. And that's an important fact. It's a trouble-free country in large measure, certainly compared to the rest of the world, and a wonderfully trouble-free relationship. But Canada is, in critical, decisive respects, important to the United States. And Don Cox outlined some of the most important respects in his comments a moment ago. And it does deserve and requires much more of our attention. Now I'm talking as an American. Trade. Canada is far and away the largest trading partner of the United States, although you would hardly ever realize that reading American newspapers. One would assume Japan is much more important, but it's really much less important. Defense in the ways that Don talked about. A third and more intangible thing, but still very important, is the very considerable moral support Canada gives to the United States in the international arena. That was brought home to our attention in a kind of shattering way during the hostage crisis in Iran, when we found out that the Canadian embassy had been the hiding place for our people. But consistently in the United Nations, Canada votes with the United States much more than, for example, France or England or Italy. Not 100%, I think it's around 86% or something like that, but very strongly. And in international organizational meetings, when you talk to someone like Alan Keyes, the Undersecretary of State for International Organizations, you learn that the Canadian delegation tends to be reliable in a way that the English are not, the French are not, the Italians are not. Not to put down our European friends, but that no one, I think the view is, tends to be quite so with us as Canada. And that makes a certain difference, because for reasons that I'll talk about in a minute, Canada has a kind of cachet with the third world, you might say, that America doesn't, coming out of the British Commonwealth heritage. Now, in all these respects, though, defense, trade, the international world and the way it's seen from the Canadian perspective, there are secondary but very important disagreements, differences. And tonight I want to try to illuminate some of the roots of those differences and disagreements. Part of my purpose here is to help Americans, you in particular, but others maybe you'll talk to be a little less surprised, a little less disappointed, a little less angry when you notice that the Canadians don't see eye to eye with the United States, because they don't. On the basis of a kind of a brotherhood of agreement, there's some really important disagreement. I want to begin with a little story. It's a true story. It's a contemporary story, and I think it's very revealing. Last year, about this time, there was published in Canada a book called A Guide to Coping with Your Back Pain. Now, this book was quite a good book on back pain, and it did very well. The first 4 months, it sold about 11,000 copies. Some of you who are in publishing will think, well, that's not too much, but you better remember the Canadian market is only 8% of the American market. So it was with good reason that McClellan and Stewart, the Canadian publishers, decided that they would auction the rights off in New York City to an American publisher. I mean, after all, back pain is universal. If you can sell 11,000 copies of a back pain book in Canada in 4 months, you can sell maybe 150,000 copies in America. So they did. They successfully auctioned it off. Prentice Hall was the successful bidder. They liked the book. The book made sense. The doctors said sound. But Prentice Hall came back to McClellan Stewart and said, just one problem, the title. What's wrong with the title, McClellan Stewart said. Well, Prentice Hall said, Americans don't really want to learn how to cope with their back pain. And so in April, a book will be published in the United States. Same text, not a word changed except the title, which is now Conquering Back Pain. And that, I think, is a very revealing vignette. There's a local Toronto novelist, Morley Torgoff, who, when he heard this, said, well, sure, if Julius Caesar had been a Canadian, he would have written, I came, I saw, I coped. And if Oliver Goldsmith had been a Canadian, his great play would have been She Stoops to Cope. But on a more serious level, I think the vignette is really quite revealing, because it's true. Canadians cope. Americans conquer. That says something about the spirit of the two peoples and the two countries. And it says something about both the virtues and the vices, I think. Americans are more energetic. They're more dynamic. They think that the destiny can be in their hands, the destiny of the country, their destiny as individuals. America has a heritage of conquering nature. The West was there to be won for Americans. For Canadians, the North is still there, and it's never been conquered. Nature for Canadians is much more something you come to terms with. Life as a relatively small country, it's big geographically, but it only has about 23 million people, and it's small, therefore, population-wise, in terms of gross national product, and certainly in terms of its military. Canada is a country that has to learn to cope with the world, and the world means, in the first place, the United States. Pierre Trudeau put it very well once, 10 or 12 years ago, he was talking to a company of American businessmen, and he said, listen, you have to understand, for us in Canada, living next to the United States is a little like sleeping every night next to a friendly elephant. Now, the lions and the wolves won't get you, but if he rolls over in the middle of the night, and that is the problem, the possibility of the inadvertent ill that might be done by the United States. Without ever thinking about Canada, they lurch off on something that has terrible consequences for us people up here in Canada, and they'll never think about it. That I think, is what Canadians, by and large, worry about. Not so much that the United States will do something malevolent, but that it'll do something thoughtless that'll get us into trouble without ever consulting us. That's, I think, a deep kind of root of the worry Canadians feel about the United States. Canadians are more stoic, low-keyed, but at the same time, perhaps a little bit less self-satisfied and a little less boastful, and a little less given to those swings of temperament and mood that the American people and the American electorate seem to go through. On one occasion being extraordinarily confident, and a few years later being extraordinarily not only hopeless, but even engaging in a certain kind of self-hatred. Canadians neither engage in the kind of confidence nor in the kind of self-hatred, I think, that one finds in the American polity. Less energy, less hope, less spirit, but a certain steadiness, I think you could say, is part of the Canadian virtues. Now, let me try to, I've given now a kind of impressionistic account, you could say, of the difference in temperament. Let me try to penetrate a little bit into the roots of these differences by conducting you on just a little tour of history, kind of a very brief and rapid survey of the history of these two democracies, trying to point to some highlights that I think are critical. And some of these were mentioned and touched on by Don. Canada was not founded in a revolution. In fact, the real roots of Canada are in, especially English Canada, are in people who fled by the thousands from the American Revolution, the people we call the Tories. Where did Benedict Arnold go? He came to Canada, and he was welcomed here as a hero, as a loyalist, as a Tory. And the name of that tradition in Canada is United Empire Loyalism. And each of those three words counts. United, that means united with England, of course. An empire, a grand destiny in the world, and loyalty. Loyalty, not revolutionary, not rebellion. Royalty to something older than any revolution. We toasted the Queen at the beginning, which I'm sure struck all of you Americans as very strange, as has always struck me, that at every departmental meeting at the Political Science Department in Toronto, we toast the Queen. And I have to ask myself, am I somehow betraying the revolution when I do this? A very different spirit, and it's not simply a kind of graceful bow to an older tradition. The Queen does still mean something in Canada, and the Commonwealth still means something, and it's hard for Americans perhaps to see how it can mean anything but something rather quaint, but it means something when it's translated into international relations and foreign affairs. There's a certain openness to the third world, and the negative or downside of that is to the third world mentality, if you know what I mean, that characterizes Canada and not the United States. Now, the Dominion of Canada, or Canada proper as a nation, as Don said, was founded in, it was founded in 1867, but the convention was 1864, and was very much a reaction to the American Civil War, as Don said. It was a reaction both to America, armed America, with this enormous army larger than the world had ever seen before, but it was also a reaction against republicanism. There was a sense in Canada that the Civil War showed the anarchic tendency of a republican society, a society that had no roots in monarchy, no roots in an aristocratic tradition, no established religion, no Anglicanism, no sturdy center ground, so to speak. There was also in Canada a sense that mass republicanism in particular was going to mean, or was likely to mean, a kind of conformism, a kind of homogenization, a kind of imposition from the center on the provinces. A resistance to all of that was part of the Canadian founding and the Canadian reaction. There was a sense in the years after the founding of satisfaction that we had prevented ourselves from becoming Americans when we looked down at the Grant administration and the kind of corruption that set in the late 19th century. Now, to be sure, there were some Canadians who felt that Canada should join the United States. Goldwin Smith was probably the most famous example. He was president of Cornell University, but also a great Canadian intellectual. But on the whole, there was a real sense of satisfaction that we had kept out of that orbit, the Canadians. I speak now as if I were a Canadian, and had remained in the English orbit. Now, none of this is to suggest that there was, however, in Canada, any sympathy for the South in the sense of slave society. On the contrary, and this I think is very important, much more important than it's usually given credit for, Canada had, of course, as Americans know sometimes as well as Canadians, a long and noble history of being the haven of escaped slaves. The Underground Railroad ended right here in Toronto. This is where they were trying to get to. And that's important because I think if you walk around Toronto today, tomorrow, One of the first things that will strike you, although you may not want to talk about it, nobody likes to talk about it too much, but I think it's crucial for understanding the difference between Toronto and American cities, and that is, we don't have a race problem. We have blacks, but we don't have a race problem. You can say, well, that's because you don't have as many blacks as we do. Well, we have as many blacks as some American cities, and it's not so much the numbers, it's something about the understanding of the place of blacks and the relationship between the two races. Canada does not have a heritage of slavery, and that's a simple but powerful fact. The blacks who are here tend to be very largely from the Caribbean or descendants of escaped slaves who came here long ago. The black family has not been destroyed by the effects and after effects of slavery. And there is not a heritage that makes blacks feel that they look back to a history which they have no part in or are somehow ashamed of. And that is, I think, a crucial part of what makes Toronto work in a way that American cities don't. Sometimes I put it to myself this way, that Toronto looks like what American cities would have looked like if we hadn't had slavery. And it's a difficult thing to talk about, but I think it's a very important feature of the success of Toronto as a city and of America, other Canadian cities as well. Now, until World War II, to finish this little history lesson, Canada looked very much to England, as Don said, to England as a kind of refuge from the influence and power of America. There was in Canada no foreign ministry. Canada had no embassies anywhere except London. England took care of all that for Canada until the end of World War I, and even really after that. Canada had a heroic, very heroic war record in World War I, and only somewhat less heroic in World War II. It fought very hard for England, gladly, willingly, and terrific bloodshed. But since World War II, a kind of inevitable drift into the American cultural and political cultural orbit has taken place. As a result, for example, there were many Americans who volunteered and fought and died in Vietnam. In America, there was much more talk about the deserters who went north. The fact is that almost as many Canadians went south and volunteered, which was not so much talked about. Canadians, ordinary Canadians, tend very much to have a good instinct for the great international issues of our time. Unfortunately, we can't say as much for Canadian intellectuals or the Canadian media. But since World War II, more and more of a being swept into the American orbit, and television here has played an enormous role. One critical geographical or geopolitical fact about Canada is that well over 90% of all Canadians live within 50 miles of the American border. And if you chart the population on the map, of course, that means that a lot of black dots clustered around the border and in a few places. Canadians watch American television, they get American magazines, they travel south to America, they retire to Florida or to South California. They're very much now part of the greater American picture. Now, some of you may be sitting there and wondering, well, what about the French Canadians, though? We've heard a lot about those, and aren't you completely neglecting them? And of course I am, partly because I don't know as much about French Canada. Like most English Canadians, we don't know a lot about our brothers in French Canada. That's changing, and later generations, the generations that are coming, it'll be different. But the fact is that Canada is very much two cultures still, two countries. But both cultures share some of the features that I've talked about already in the English Canadian culture. The French Canadians, I'll just say a couple of words about them, descended, of course, from fur traders who were conquered by the English. You might well expect, therefore, that they would have been very sympathetic to the American Revolution. And on a famous occasion in 1775, the Continental Congress of the United States sent a famous message to the French Canadians, invoking the names of Montesquieu and Rousseau, and calling them to join arms as comrades in arms against British imperialism. A very moving message which received no answer whatsoever. The French Canadians were, to say the least, unmoved by Montesquieu. French Canada has its roots really in a very much pre-French revolutionary, pre-enlightenment kind of tradition, a strong and very conservative Catholic church, a rural kind of rootedness that makes French Canada, if anything, more conservative than English Canada. That's changed to some extent in the last couple of generations. Something that's been called the Quiet Revolution has occurred in French Canada. The forces of modern industrialization and transformation have occurred. But French Canada remains, I think, if anything, in its roots, still more conservative. And in some ways more, not anti-Republican, but somewhat dubious about liberal republicanism than the English Canadians. Now, what's the legacy of this history I've sketched? And let's come back to the present day, and let me try to reflect on some of the fruits of this history. Putting it very generally, I think you can say, in Canada, there is considerably less emphasis on individual rights than in the United States, and considerably more emphasis, I'm talking here about matters of degree, more emphasis on duties of individuals to be part of and play a role in a larger social whole, and going along with that, a much greater sympathy with, openness to the government as a source of not merely authority and refereeship and rules, but a kind of paternalism, a kind of looking to government to take care of the country as a whole, and to the individual to play his or her part in that government or that larger whole. Not just with regard to law and order, but with regard to decency, welfare, and even to some extent spiritual goods, religion. Government is allowed as having a role that in America, I think even liberal Democrats would be uneasy with. And surely, for example, the ACLU would be very uneasy with. Now let me try to spell this out a little bit more specifically with some cases or some instances of this. Let me look at the good and the bad aspects of this lesser emphasis on individual rights that I talk about. And I'm sure many of you would disagree with what I put the good and the bad categories, but at least this will clarify the situation. There's much less of a litigious spirit in Canada. People are much less likely to think that they should bring their neighbors to court, or that the court is the place to settle your quarrels. That may be changing with the new Charter of Rights, but there has been much less of a tradition of the Supreme Court, even in recent times, or the equivalent, playing a great role in the Canadian political system. There's stronger legal and political support for the family, I think you can say, in Canada. The divorce laws have been slower to change. The government gives direct support for children. If you have a child, you get so many hundreds of dollars and so on. There's much less, I think you'll find this something striking as you walk around in Toronto, much less pornography. And the pornography that's here is what they call soft core down south of the border. There's no counterpart to the belief that only if you have sadomasochistic magazines can you also read Shakespeare, or that somehow great literature is threatened unless you tolerate and allow almost anything. There's been, in fact, recently a pretty strong reaction in Canada to sadomasochistic pornography. Even so powerful and prestigious a magazine as Penthouse has been banned and confiscated recently in Canada when it was felt it had gone too far, and there was very little outcry. There's much less opposition to gun control legislation in Canada, another visceral point in American political scene, which is very hard for Canadians, I think, to understand. Canadians love to hunt, and hunting is a big pastime here, but there's really very little opposition to the idea that handguns should be very strictly controlled. In criminal law, the Canadian police still have available to them writs of assistance. You may remember those from your high school history courses. Those were the things we fought the revolution over. A writ of assistance is an open-ended search warrant. To assist a police officer in finding the evidence of crime, he has a writ which says pretty much, Wherever he wants to look, he can look. These are rare in Canada, but they're there to be used. There is no Miranda rule in Canada. And I have some friends who are policemen, neighbors, who have told me that it's kind of amusing that when Canadians get arrested, they tend to say, "You didn't read me my rights," because they've watched American television, you see. They are unaware that this is not a country where there are necessarily such rights. There is in Canada a national police force. That's what the Mounties are. The Mounties are not just a bureau of investigation. They're a national police force in a way we don't know in the United States. Getting to the negative side, however, and not to say that there aren't some negative implications in some of the things I've mentioned, there is no reference to property rights in the Canadian Constitution, or what is the equivalent of the Bill of Rights. This, despite the fact that there's a strong English and common law tradition of sanctity of property rights. But in Canada, I think it's fair to say, there is less feeling of the sanctity of property rights. There is not that great tradition of having fought a revolution, no taxation without representation. And there is nothing like the Fifth Amendment and its guarantee of no deprivation of property without due process of law. Not to say, of course, that property rights have not been severely eroded recently in the United States, but they've been eroded from a level that I think was never the same in Canada. There's no strict separation in Canada of church and state. On the contrary, it's been a strong tradition from the beginning in Canada to have direct government support for parochial schools of many different denominations. In fact, there are some provinces of Canada which have no non-denominational public schools. In Nova Scotia, the public schools are Protestant. Now, nowadays, of course, that's given a very liberal interpretation. You don't really have to participate in prayer service and so on. But still, a much less strict, or if you will, doctrinaire tradition of the wall between church and state that you find in the United States. Much more a sense that it's part of a decent, ordered, and free society to pay acknowledgement to some kind of divine guidance. And indeed, in the Canadian Constitution, there is an acknowledgement of the fact that this is a country under God. Another instance close to home, by the way, of that is that the University of Toronto is very largely an affiliated university made out of church and denominational schools. Implied in a way of much of what I said before is that there's not in Canada anything to correspond to what you might call the ACLU spirit, which sees a fascist wherever it finds someone supporting religion, or which insists that pornography is the front lines on which we defend the right to read Shakespeare and so on. Canadians are much more inclined to be, in many regards, I would say, sensible about where the line should be drawn between private assertiveness and public, and a sort of sense of public decency and civility. Let me turn now to the consequences of this tradition that I mentioned earlier of a somewhat greater and more paternalistic role for the government. The most obvious thing, if any of you get, I hope you don't, but have any medical difficulties while you're here, is you'll find that there is a very complete socialized medicine in Canada. You probably heard of this if you don't have to experience it. And it works quite well with some rough exceptions. We've just got through a fairly serious doctor's strike here in Ontario, but on the whole, socialized medicine is, I think, here to stay in Canada and probably going to get more and more control by government. That probably means a brain drain to the south. That's the downside risk. Or the cost. There's, on a more positive note, I think you can say a stronger kind of civic spirit, not just nationally, but even more important on the local level. I think you'll sense that as you walk around Toronto, take the subway, ride the bus. The litter laws really are enforced here, not by the police, but by other people. If you drop a candy wrapper on the floor of the subway, you're likely to have a little old lady tapping you on the shoulder saying, You dropped your wrapper. Children who misbehave in public are often chastised by the adults who happen to be around. When I first moved here, I found this one of the most amazing things that I'd ever seen in an American city before. Adults gathering to tell children to stop doing things, which doesn't happen very often in American cities. It still happens in smaller towns, but it's part of the spirit. The city planning of Toronto, the subway system, are instances of a willingness to see that some kind of government regulation properly and judiciously applied is an important part of the political picture. There isn't a doctrinaire resistance to that from either the left or more important, the right in Canada. There is, above all, and this is something Don Knox touched on, a deep and very vibrant tradition of civility in Canada. And I would make a distinction here, civility as opposed to patriotism. Not that the Canadians are unpatriotic, but they're less likely to think in terms of the country as a whole and its place in the world, and more likely to think of how the neighborhood can keep itself clean, decent, orderly, and so on. It's more a spirit of citizens together on a smaller scale rather than a heroic sense of the national destiny. It's a public virtue, but it's not quite a national kind of virtue or a nationalism. On the other hand, and this I think has to be quickly added before the Canadians begin to bask too much in the glow of my praise, there's a lot less charity in Canada. Private giving is just not much of a tradition here. You notice this as an American in many ways when you first come here. For example, when you fill out your income tax, it's clear that the tax laws assume that almost nobody gives to private charity here. Whereas in America, when you fill out your income tax, you're not questioned on every receipt in the way you are here. If you walk around the University of Toronto, you'll notice there are some buildings named after people, but if you're here for a while, you discover this amazing fact. There's not a single building at the University of Toronto named after the person who gave the money for the building, because nobody ever gave money for a building at the University of Toronto. There is not a single chaired professor at the University of Toronto. And when I first came here, I thought it must be they have a rule against chaired professors. And I asked somebody, they said, no, we'd love to have one. No one ever gave the money for a chaired professorship here at the University of Toronto. The spirit of the country is the government takes care of education. Therefore, why should I help to set up a chair? And this goes further than what might seem at first these superficial things I've mentioned. These are signs of something deeper. There is no tradition in Canada of the private university. There is no Ivy League or anything close to it. There are public universities, but there is no private university, and that makes an enormous difference. Because in America, the public universities, the state schools, somehow have to live up to the standards set by the private schools. If there weren't the Ivy League, the University of Minnesota, I suspect, would not be as good a university as it is. That's not quite the case in Canada. So far, the University of Toronto and other universities have had to live up to the standards set by American universities. And this is something that I want to talk about just a little bit more in a few minutes. But the last thing I wanted to talk about with regard to the government is, of course, what you would expect. There's a much more intrusive and powerful bureaucracy in Canada. If you get audited on your income taxes, it's tougher than in the United States. There isn't the same tradition of resistance to and questioning the legitimacy of government officialdom as there is in the United States. That means to say, for example, that in the human rights field, there has been much less resistance to affirmative action. In fact, affirmative action is, in effect, written into the new Canadian Constitution. Many human rights can be suspended in the name of affirmative action, officially without any question. There's much more likelihood of prosecuting claims of racism or sexual harassment without regard for some of the dangerous consequences, chilling and frightening consequences for government interference in personal relationships. There's much more government ownership as well as regulation of the economy. Petro-Canada would be the great example. And yet, in Canada has not, however, paid as high a price as one might suppose, or as some would say it should have, for the degree of socialism that Canada has. And this is due to a paradoxical but key fact, and that is the United States, that Canada is compelled somehow to compete with this much more free market and free enterprise society to the south. That fact has meant that Canada has been kept away from the brink of some of the worst pitfalls that it might naturally have rolled into. Another very important fact connected with this is, you may, as you walk around the city and see how well it works now, well it's kept up and so on, start to ask yourself, how do they afford it? Why can't we do that in New York City? Or where do they get the money for all this? And one big answer is, there is no defense budget. When I say no defense budget, there really is no defense budget here. I don't know how it compares with Japan, but I suspect Canada's defense budget is not that much more substantial. There is a shopping center out in Edmonton, which one of the world's largest shopping centers, and the owner decided, in order to really give the place a feature, that he would buy three submarines and place them in a large artificial tank in the middle. It might be true. It's one of those plausible facts. And Canada very much depends on the United States for its umbrella. And in that respect, it's very different from Sweden, for example, which has to spend an awful lot of money on defense, precisely because it's not in NATO, but which at least lives up to its claim to be, you know, a neutral, independent, socialist country. Canada wants to have it and does have it in a way both ways. It's quasi or to some extent socialist and very heavily dependent on American free enterprise to pay the bill indirectly. And Canadians tend not to want to admit that, although the honest ones certainly do, I think. The populace, as I mentioned before with my little story from the policeman who arrests people who ask them to read their Miranda rights, a populace is very much, you might say, infected with American TV and therefore American culture. The populace is infected with a more individualistic, rights-oriented view that filters up south of the border. And, of course, there are strong economic pressures to keep up with America. So that, for example, the successful Reagan-Bradley tax reform is already having big repercussions in Canada. Already the Mulroney government is beginning to tout its own tax reform. And I don't think that's just words. I think they really feel under pressure. They've got to do something about the tax system here in order to keep the business and the productivity going here once the change has occurred in the United States. The last thing I want to mention about these consequences, as it were, of the history is foreign policy. Canada, still in foreign policy, although it tends to be very supportive of the United States, also feels itself to be endowed with a kind of mission to the third world. And this is a kind of legacy of British imperialism, the white man's burden, if you will, a sense that we here in Canada have a sympathy for, an understanding for the third world that Americans can't have, and we have to somehow be the brokers. And this is the cause of a considerable amount of idiocy. However, can sometimes be useful because it's a myth to some extent, but it's one of those myths that if enough people believe it, it becomes somewhat true. Canada can sometimes in important international meetings play something of a broker's role, but unfortunately I think Canada has a very much exaggerated view of what it can do in this regard. And this was one of the more amusing or infuriating aspects of the Trudeau administration, and seems to continue to some extent with the Mulroney administration. But it's something that Americans are likely to notice, get very irritated by, feel betrayed by, or wonder what the heck is going on up there. And I think Americans have to try to understand this is the way Canada shall we say, shoots off its mouth or tries to have some weight in the world. And my advice to my fellow Americans is indulge them. Recognize that Canada does have a strong tradition of an imperial background that does give it a sense of kinship with the Third World and requires it, morally, so to speak, and part of its conscience, to sometimes act the role of the proud little brother standing up to the United States and saying, "You're forgetting some important things." And sometimes I think it does it usefully. Sometimes. Now, the last thing I want to talk about is the character of Canadian conservatism as a kind of consequence of all I've tried to very quickly go through in terms of the history and the difference in the political systems. The distinctiveness of Canadian conservatism, I think, flows kind of reasonably from the distinctiveness I've tried to limb or outline in the political system. There's a difference, I think, in the spectrum of conservative opinion in Canada. And here some of my fellow members of the Charlottetown Society may correct me because I may not be reproducing accurately what the case is. But from my point of view, it seems to me that libertarianism is quite a bit weaker in Canada than it is in the United States. It's present. But especially radical libertarianism, a radically individualistic outlook of the more doctrinaire and so to speak, theoretical sort, is much less in evidence, perhaps a bit more out west, but certainly much less in Ontario. And therefore, on issues such as some of the ones I mentioned, religion, freedom of speech, pornography, abortion, one does not find so radically individualistic and libertarian a perspective among conservatives. On the other hand, what's present in Canada and missing in the United States is a fairly strong Tory sort of conservatism, you might say. I have in mind someone like George Grant, you may have heard of, a leading Canadian right-wing intellectual, who stands for a kind of conservatism that is much more old-fashioned than anything we tend to see in the United States. A kind of nostalgia for England, for Anglican community, not fundamentalist religion, but religion of a more established sort. It goes together with a kind of distrust of capitalism, distrust of America as a capitalist, individualistic, bourgeois society, and a kind of openness or kinship with Marx on the right wing of Canadian conservatism that's quite unfamiliar to Americans, and I think initially leaves them quite baffled or puzzled, but would be more familiar to Americans who know something about European conservatism. And goes with what I find is a somewhat unhealthy anti-Americanism or dubiousness about America in foreign policy, a failure to grasp the gravity of the great contest between the Soviet Union and the United States in our time. But in general, I think it's fair to say that among conservatives in Canada, and especially I think in the Charlottetown Society, there's a broad support for the free market, for a free enterprise system, for the kind of initiative and liberty that characterizes that kind of a society and system. A pro-American stand in foreign policy is generally characteristic of Canadian conservatives. A real worry about the Soviet threat, a real worry about the fact that Canadians don't worry enough about it, an irritation verging on fury with the media that seems to belittle this great contest in which so much is at stake, and a kind of sense of being disturbed by Canada's softness on the Third World as well as the East-West issues. The last thing I'd say about Canadian conservatism is that there really is no neoconservatism in Canada. And I thought about this a bit because I'm not sure why that is, and I'm puzzled over it. In Canada, in fact, I think there's very little comprehension of what in the world neoconservatism is. And that's true among people who reflect about conservatism. I think the reason is this. Conservatism in Canada already has, or always did have, many of those elements which neoconservatism in the United States has tried to rediscover as part of the conservative legacy. By that I mean conservatism in Canada, because of this Tory streak I mentioned, always has been much more aware than conservatism sometimes has been in the United States of the importance of culture, religion, the family, of the non-economic dimensions of the conservative outlook. I think neoconservatism was largely an attempt to, or in some important respect, an attempt to broaden and inject into a conservative outlook something that goes beyond a rather narrowly economic outlook. And Canadian conservatism has always been broader in that sense. On the other hand, or in the second place, Canadian conservatism has always been what the neoconservatives tend to be, somewhat more open to the New Deal and all that it represents, or somewhat more open to sensible, limited, but still important government, a role for government in the economy, but also in the civic life of the country. This may not be adequate to explain it, but I think it helps explain why neoconservatism has really not put down any roots in Canada. I don't think it's because Canada is hostile to what neoconservatism stands for. I think it's rather that Canada has always been somewhat neoconservative in its conservatism. So this really ends my little tour of introduction to Canada. I did want to close with a somewhat different note, a kind of personal note, though I think it's relevant and illuminating about Canada and conservatives, but about Canada in general. I'm not a Canadian, as I've said. I'm a resident of Canada. I'm a resident alien, as we would say in the United States. I'm a permanent resident alien. I'm an American. Why am I here? I was asked this at dinner, a reasonable question. How did you come to be here? And the answer, as Don Cox mentioned at the beginning, was, well, the University of Toronto was the only place that would give me a job after I was fired at Yale. And the head of the committee that was supervising my firing, in a famous statement, public statement, said people like me and Leninists, meaning the right and the left, had no place at Yale. It's no accident that I found a kind of haven here at the University of Toronto. When no one else would hire George Will in the 60s, he was hired by the University of Toronto, and this is where his career began. When Walter Burns and Alan Bloom resigned from Cornell University because radical blacks with guns in their hands had taken over the campus, no American university would touch them with a 10-foot pole, and the University of Toronto hired them. The philosophy department is not just my department. The philosophy department at the University of Toronto has a long and fine tradition of an older kind of philosophy. Thomas Aquinas, Hegel, names that you may have heard of like Emil Fackenheim and Professor Pegas, people who couldn't get jobs at American universities because they had been completely taken over by fashionable so-called linguistic analysis and logical positivism, which turned out to be much more intolerant and doctrinaire than any older view would have dreamed of being. The English department at the University of Toronto, similarly, Northrop Frye, it's got a richer and broader tradition. Now what these are instances of are the fact that the University of Toronto, and in this way it's somewhat reflective in a deep way of Canadian society in general, has a genuine, not just talk, but genuine commitment to diversity. A genuine sense that Canada and the university and the city ought to be open to and prepared to learn from a wide variety of points of view. Because the University of Toronto is not a conservative university. That's not why conservatives have found a haven here. There are also noted Marxists at this university who also would have trouble getting jobs in American universities. What makes the University of Toronto striking, and what makes the city striking, as you walk around, I think you'll have a sense of this, is an openness to different ways of thinking and living, and a reluctance to try to rush to homogenize them or force them to assimilate. Multiculturalism is the tag word for this, and although it covers a lot of vices, it also covers some virtues. and perhaps some of the most important Canadian virtues. It's part of that virtue of civility that I talked about a little earlier. Part of that virtue is not just getting along and being civic spirited about the neighborhood, but genuinely opening to and being a haven for a variety of points of view and ways of thinking. And one has to understand this. Canada is not a country that fosters diversity. What I mean by that is, it's not a place that produces it itself. And that has something to do with the fact that there are no great conflicts here, because I think conflict is a crucial part of that crucible out of which diversity arises, and Canada is not a very conflictually ridden society. But it makes a home for diversity that comes from abroad. And I think that that's one of the real virtues of Canada, and one that certainly for conservatives, not only from America but other places, has made a very great difference. So with that note of homage to my haven country, not my home country, I will conclude. And I guess we can have questions.
Yeah.